Hi, it's Dan here for Dusty Discs Radio, and this is the podcast Liner Notes, revealing chats with Canada's retro music makers. Today, I'm very honored to have as my special guest, promoter extraordinaire and highly regarded music industry professional, Ron Sakamoto. He has worked for many decades as a promoter for some of the biggest shows and bands on the planet. Yeah, so we'll get some insights about the Canadian music scene from someone who's been there and been an integral part of it for, I guess, six decades now. So thanks for joining me today, Ron. How are you?
Hi, Dan. How are you? Wait, that makes me sound old.
Six decades. How did that happen?
You know what? It went by so fast, I really don't know how it happened, but it's been a ride for sure. It's been a great, great ride, you know?
Yeah, awesome. Well, so from a young guy, I see here born in Coaldale, Alberta, and been a good Canadian boy and a good prairie boy for your whole life, I guess, right?
We bought a farm in Medicine Hat, and that's nice. Where I grew up, on the farm. And so I grew up in Medicine Hat, actually.
And then you eventually made your way to Lethbridge, I see. So in that.
Yes. You know, the reason why I came to Lethbridge is when I started my first club.
Yeah, I was born in Coaldale.
I guess I was moved to Medicine Hat, 20 years old. It was called a honeycomb. And right. Then my mentor was Mayor Harry Viner, who really helped me a lot. He was a businessman and just enjoyed what, you know, I was going to do. But he told me, Ron, you know, I think that you should get another club, because if you had two clubs, you know, that you could book the same band Friday in one city and Saturday in the other city, and then have the other band playing Friday in that city and Saturday in Medicine Hat. And so you could buy the bands cheaper for two nights than one night. And so I said, okay. So, you know, he was a real astute businessman. And so that's why I moved to Lethbridge and started the varsity club in Lethbridge. And then I also ran the one in Medicine Hat too, but I had the general manager run that.
Right. Well, that's cool, because I was, you know, I'm looking at your timeline here, and then you got into hockey, and then eventually I guess you got an injury, and then you thought, well, music. And one of the things I like about what you've said over the years is you love bringing the joy of music to others, and that's kind of your gift to the world.
Yeah, you know, it's so neat, you know, to see people go out of concerts or clubs, you know, just happy. And you know, they come in and see the show, and then after the show, you know, they're going out singing, dancing, you know, just having a great time. And it's so neat to see that. And I just really enjoy, I guess, you know, just making them happy.
Yeah. Well, and then so it's in the early 60s, and then you opened a club, and then you opened another club. And I was thinking, you know, young people, it sounds pretty cheeky, you know, for a young farm kid to open a club and then open another club and then sort of think that you can get into that end of the business. What were you thinking at the time? Just a young guy thinking I can go for it?
Well, yeah, I did, you know, I did play hockey and I got hurt. I played junior and I got hurt in Calgary playing at the Corral. And I think I was 18 at the time. And so I'm in the hospital and watching television. And on Saturdays, they used to have American Bandstand on, right?
Yes.
And I'm thinking, holy cow, you know, the kids are having a blast, you know. And this was in Philadelphia. And I'm thinking, wow. And Medicine Hat had nothing. We had nothing there. I mean, every weekend, you know, we just drive around the block and or try to find parties or make parties. And they had nothing for the kids to do. And so I thought, wow, you know, I think this would be great. And so then I asked my parents if they would, you know, help me out. And they said, yeah, well, what do you want to do? Well, they're farmers. They really didn't know too much about music, but they trusted me. So then that's when I first met the mayor, Harry Viner, who had an old bowling alley that was shut down. And then I could go and I asked him if I could rent it. And he said, what for? And I told him my idea. And he was the mayor at the time. And he said, wow, Medicine Hat needs that. They need something for the kids. I'm going to help you. I'm going to, you know. And he said, listen, you take that old bowling alley and you fix it to a dance hall. And if you make money, pay me. If you don't make money, don't pay me. And he was the mayor, and he told me how to come to the city council, how to do this and how to get this and how to do that and how to promote. And, you know, he really was my mentor, and he was an amazing, amazing person, and taught me a lot of things. Yeah. And he, you know, that's how I got started.
Well, very nice. And then I heard a quote years ago that always stuck with me, but it went like this: and get the young people to do it because they don't know what they can't do. And I always thought that was smart because you just go ahead and do it. You've got young energy, you got enthusiasm, and you just go for it.
You know, Dan, I had most of my friends say, "Hey, Ron, what are you trying to do?" Right? And a lot of people saying, "Hey, what are you trying to do?" You know, like they couldn't believe I was going to do this. And so I said, "Well, this is, you know, something that I think would really work. And what really Medicine Hat really needs is something for the kids." And at that time, I mean, what did we have? We had, what, television that was just getting started, black and white. We didn't really have, you know, all the amenities that they have today. Computers, there's no computers back then.
Yeah, no.
You know, there was just zero. And so anyway, you know, I had it in my own mind that because I saw this work in the United States, American Bandstand, I thought it would work here in Canada too. And so I, you know, went ahead and got a lot of advice from the mayor and Mary Harbiner, and I got a lot of advice from business people, and, you know, because I didn't know anything about that. And so then I learned, and then, you know, I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And then back then too, that's when promo and those kinds of parts of the business were very labor intensive, right? There was no online, no social media. You do posters, hand advertising, maybe the radio station, that sort of stuff. So you were back in the trenches, as it were.
Oh, right in the trenches, because we had to go to the station and make a deal with the stations, you know? And so what I did was, I was the only game in town. So what I did do is I made a deal with the radio station that if they would promote all my shows and at my club, you know, that, you know, I would get a deal from them, and they could put their name on it, right? Nice. Presented by CJOC or presented by Chat Radio and Medicine Hat. And so that, you know, we cut a deal way back then, right? And it was great for both of us.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking when you look back. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so I experienced some of that. But, you know, having the radio station do a location event, for example, or come down and create a splash for you, too. Did you ever do that? There's different techniques you had to use back then.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, what I did do to really start my club off was I went to city council, invited all the aldermen and Mayor Harry Viner, of course, and I had go-go girls, you know, because the honeycomb, a go-go, and they had a go-go dance contest. So I invited everybody down, and then the mayor invited the TV stations, the radio stations, the newspapers, and it was packed. And they invited the parents, too, if they wanted to come. And so that all of a sudden, it meant that the city council, the mayor, all the, you know, hierarchy was really, really backing this. And it was great for the city. It was great for the kids to come to. And Dan, I'm telling you, it was packed every weekend. It was packed because, you know, we really made a splash.
Yeah. Well, your overriding point is a good one, too. You got to bring people on board and get people involved, right? It's not a one-man show in that sense. You need the community. You need, like you said, the mayor, whoever can help to pile in and help.
That's exactly what we did because, you know, you can't do it yourself. And you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. And so I tried to get, real good people that would help me. Radio stations, newspapers, you know, columnists, television station, you know, everybody that, you know, would help.
Well, and you would have, you probably owned a hammer stapler and you would out and hammered a lot of posters on telephone poles and stuff. Did you do that?
You wouldn't believe how many posters I put up. My fingers were sore every week, you know. It wasn't a lot of fun, but you had to get it out there, you know.
Yeah, well, that was the only way. I mean, nowadays, think of it. You can put an ad on Facebook and reach thousands of people. Good Lord, to reach 1,000 people or 2,000 people back then, you know, took a lot of labor, right? A lot of work.
It did. You had to have television, radio, newspaper, and your stapler.
Well, then the other thing too is the phone bills. That's one thing that maybe the young people don't realize. But back then, especially if you're booking acts from around, you know, North America or whatever, your phone bills would be ridiculous, right? You must have paid a lot of money in phone bills over the years.
Oh, man, it was a lot, because that's all we had. We didn't have no flip phones. You didn't, you know, it was just your home phone, your business phone. Or that's what you had. You didn't have anything else. You didn't have computers. You didn't have anything.
Yeah, and then paying a lot. I mean, the phone bills. My phone bills in the 80s were way more than they are now.
Oh yeah, it was a big expense for sure. It was a big expense.
That's funny looking back, eh? And then so you got into promoting shows. I guess it just sort of morphed from there. And that's a bit of a risky business, a bit of a blood sport too, right? I mean, that you got to be smart and work hard and manage your risk. How did you approach that?
Well, Dan, we had the clubs going for a number of years. And then all of a sudden, it started to, the bands wanted more money as they got bigger, right? Right. And the club would hold 500 and the other one would hold 800. And so, and Lethbridge would hold 800. So what happened was I'm thinking, okay, the bands want way more money. I can only put so many people in and I can only charge so many dollars. So, you know, I'm going to have to start a promoting company to get into bigger buildings, like the arenas, right, the Jubilee auditoriums. So I can take these bands that want more money into those places. So that's what I said, okay, I guess I better start a promoting company, not just the clubs, but the promoting company. And that's why I started Golden Gold Productions.
Right. And that was, you started Golden Gold in 68, is that correct?
I think a little earlier than that, maybe 60, yeah, something like that, 66, 64, something like that.
So, but that's, again, you're going into a bit of a minefield there. You got to put up some money. You got to put up some risk, a high reward, high risk sometimes, right?
Well, that's true. But, you know, but by then, you know, with two clubs going, I had saved quite a bit of money and instead of buying new cars, you know, I put my money away. Like, my father sat me down and said, listen, you know, save your money, don't have any debts, save your money. And that's, you know, that's what I did. But you're right. I mean, it is a lot more risk, because now I don't own the building. You know, you rent the building, and you still got to do all the advertising for the shows. And so, yeah, guarantees to the bands. Absolutely. Now, the guarantees at that time are a lot lower than now. I mean,
right.
And some bands would work with you and just say, okay, Ron, we'll go percentage, you know, some would. So, you know, it cuts your
risk. Or do you do low guarantees with incentives on top sometimes?
And higher, yes, lower guarantees and a higher percentage, you know, so. If they sell, they'll make more money. And if they don't sell, you know, you won't lose your shirt. So,
well, that's a good way to do it. And I've always been an advocate of that too, because I'm friends with lots of promoters. And I don't know if you know Les Vogt. You must have run into him.
Oh, sure.
He's on the West Coast. So I know Les very well. I've done lots of shows with him, but I want everybody to win. Like, it doesn't help our industry if someone puts up a show and then the show tanks and that person gets stung. That's not going to help any of us. So I always say the better it is for each of us, the better it is for all of us.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Dan. You know, because if you kill a promoter, he won't be around anymore, right?
No, that's right.
And so then the bands, where are they going to play and who are they going to play for?
Well, yeah, and that's right. And then Les made the point one time, I think I'm okay to quote him, but he said, you know, virtually every band that had any kind of success over the last, say, 50 years is out there looking for gigs. You know, they want to play and they want to make money and they have to work with the promoters to make sure everybody does okay. So, yeah.
That's exactly right. It's a, you got to have a win-win. It doesn't matter what. Yeah. You got to have a win-win situation. And, you know, I fortunately had that, you know, a lot of a great win-win situations with a lot of bands and a lot of managers and a lot of agents.
Yeah. So what got me, though, when I was reading, so you expanded even beyond music, like to wrestling competitions and truck shows and stuff. I'm thinking, okay, so you know the music business and, of course, you know the promo business, but then you're going into a bit of a minefield, potentially a minefield in some of these other areas, too. How did that work out?
Well, you know, promotion is promotion, you know. And so when all of a sudden I got a call from the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, I'm thinking, the Harlem Globetrotters. Wow, you know, they're calling me to promote their tour. Yeah. And, you know, basketball. Well, you know, Canada wasn't very big in basketball. But guess what? Because so many people had seen the Harlem Globetrotters on television, right? Oh, yeah. I brought them into Canada. And my goodness, for the kids and family, it was one of the best entertainment values ever.
Absolutely great.
Agree. Yeah, and so I did them, and then I thought, wow, you know, what about rodeos, indoor rodeos? What about truck shows? You know, what about, like, monster truck? You see them on television, you know, I'm thinking, wow, what would happen if I brought that in? And I tried, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't, but, you know, it was a different, I guess, way of making money in the promoting business. And then we did boxing matches.
Nice.
So, like, at the end of the day, you know, promotion is promotion, and circuses. And then I did ice shows when Disney on Ice came around and called me and said, would you promote our Disney on Ice? And I said, absolutely, we'll give it a shot. And so, and it really worked because nobody had seen these before, right?
And then the family stuff, if you can bring your family to Disney on Ice or something, I mean, your demographic immediately expands to basically everybody, right?
Tenfold, you know, because now you're getting the kids from 8, 9, 7 years old to grandfathers, you know, 60, 70 years old, going to the same show, and their mothers and dads. So you got the whole spectrum, right? And when you get that, you're going to do very, very well. And there wasn't very many family shows at that time either. So, you know, I got kind of lucky in that sort of sense.
Yeah, good. No, I was thinking about that. So the family stuff is nice, but then some of the boxing, maybe some of the other shows you might have to deal with some unscrupulous people or any issues or problems come up in those areas?
Well, you know, in the boxing, it was a little different because it was run by, you know, just a couple guys in Toronto and New York. And I had a few run-ins, but, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, you gotta be honest, and they gotta be honest. And if you don't, or if they don't, you know, forget it. So I didn't do a whole pile because, you know, to me, that wasn't, you know, guys beating up guys is not my style.
Right. Well, and again, your demo is much less, right?
Yeah, it's much less, and it's a different type of person who likes, you know. Yeah. That entertainment
and narrower. So, but the thing is, my sense of you is that you're sort of this positive mindset person. So if things come along that take away from that, you just kind of skate around them like a defenseman on the other team, right? You skate around it and carry on and score your goal anyways. Is that an accurate description of how you?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way of looking at it, you know, because certainly there's a lot of shows that I didn't want to do or, you know, things I didn't want to promote. And so that's exactly right, because there's a lot of different promoters and other people like you know, doing that, and I didn't. So, you know, I mean, you know, I just stood my ground and said, I'm going to do this and this and this and not this and this. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I was happy with what I did.
Yeah. No, good. And then I almost always ask my guests, how much of what you were able to do was a function of the time in which you lived, right? You talk in the early 60s, the golden age of sort of pop rock music and Elvis and Roy Orbison. And, you know, that time I don't think will ever come again. But how much of what you did was a function of the time?
Oh, almost all of it. You know, I've got to tell you, when I started, I mean, I was doing Johnny Cash, and he was rock at the time, Johnny Cash, yeah. Conway Twitty, and Roy Orbison. I did Roy Orbison, you know, but it was so much neater then, because everything was raw. What you saw is what you got. You know, they went on stage and they sang, and my goodness, you know, when I first saw Roy, you know, I was in shock. He went up to do sound check on stage.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable. And same with Johnny Cash. I mean, you know, he'd get up there and just wail away, you know, with his guitar, do sound check. And then he'd go and have something to eat, and, you know, we'd feed him, and then the show started. But all these guys were so real, you know. There was no, and there wasn't all this huge lights and huge sound. And, you know, it was just basic, and that's all they cared for. That's when I started, you know. You know, when at the very, very start, almost.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a real excitement back then, though, too, right? That's kind of waned. I think nowadays there's more of a saturation in the business, I guess, is one of the changes. But back then, it was, you know, you live in a town in Alberta and stuff, and Johnny Cash is coming to town. That's a big deal, right?
Yeah, you know, and we had one truck, you know, for sound and with a few lights, right?
Yeah.
And now, you know, we do shows and there are 12 trucks, 14 trucks, semi-trailers. I mean, you know, it's, you know, got out of hand in some ways. And the problem is that it's so expensive. And the artists now want so much money, right? And, you know, because they got all this backup and they got dancers and singers and this and that and everything else. So, you know, you have to be really, really careful now of who you book because of the dollars, because you can't, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to be charging people $1,000 or $700 or, I mean, they can't afford to do that. Now, people will pay that and maybe only go to one show and that's it for the year, or two shows.
Yeah.
Before, we used to go, they used to go to 10, right? And so, you know, it's gotten to the point where everybody wants so much money, you know, you got to be very careful of who you book, because, you know, there's no fine line. You know, when you lose, you're going to lose a lot because they want so much money.
Well, even some of the bands will go on tour and go back and be in debt because of the expenses they've incurred.
Oh, absolutely. Well, because 6 to 10 to 12 semi-trailers with equipment, I mean, that's cost a fortune on the road, right?
Yeah.
And all the stagehands, they're all union. So, you know, all the expense, it's just astronomical. Well,
there was a couple of big bands that were leapfrogging too. Like they would have two sets of production so that, cause it took 2 days to set up. So then of course you got to get the venue for 2 days so you can set up the full production. And then you have to have two sets. I don't know, it was the Stones or one of the big bands, maybe Madonna. I'm not sure.
Yeah. There's a few again, of them who do that, right? There's a few of them who do that and have two sets of equipment and
crazy
leapfrog. But you know, so that's double your expenses. And I don't know. I just don't know how, you know, they can make it because there's so much expense, right?
Yeah. But then, you know, and back to the sort of raw that you were talking about, you know, I watched the Super Bowl show, like with Usher and stuff. And to me, personally, it's a lot more sizzle than steak, if you know what I mean.
Wow.
A lot of flash, a lot of
if
dancing.
If you could see it all, what he had out there, I don't think you could see it all at once. There's so many people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he had bands and you had this and you had dancers. I mean, I don't know how you could see it all. But
marching band.
It was amazing, you know, as far as being put together. But, you know, to focus on one thing or two things, I mean, I don't know. So it was hard because it was all over the place, right?
Yeah.
And so, I felt it was a good show, but boy, it was a spectacular type of, show, because it held on the field, right? Some of the guys were on stages, but he was on the field and took almost half the field, right, to do this show.
Well, that's to your point, like the production is just completely... Now, of course, that's a big show, but then, you know, I compared it to the Bruno Mars one, right? Now, Bruno Mars has talent. He comes out, he's playing drums, he does the James Brown dance, he's a great singer. To me, there's more steak than sizzle in that particular show, for example.
Right, right. No, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, that was a spectacular, I guess. Usher's was kind of a big spectacular with everything. Yep. I mean, he had everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the kitchen sink.
And the kitchen sink. And
even
other
the roller
artists.
Skates.
And the roller skates. Yeah, I was like, oh, skate. I was waiting him to fall. You know. But anyway,
that's too funny.
Yeah, it was a lot of people out there. I don't know how many, but if you counted them, it was amazing. So many people.
Yeah, crazy. So, in all the people you've worked with over the years, were you ever starstruck? Did you ever meet somebody that you just thought, okay, this person is a very impressive entertainer and human being?
You know, there's so many. There's so many. But one that really strikes me, I mean, for voice, Roy Orbison was the best. Personality and I mean, there's a lot, you know. I mean, there's Wayne Newton. He was an awesome person. I was really scared to book his show because at that time he was the biggest showman in Vegas, right?
Oh yeah.
And we brought him up to Canada and for many years but you know, he was such a great guy. The Bee Gees. You know, I met Robert Stigwood when he flew into Calgary and we were doing the Bee Gees and at the Jubilees, and we sold, I don't know, four or five shows a city. And they were, you know, really, really nice people. But, you know, I mean, you know, even Taylor Swift, when I brought her, she was opening act for Brad Paisley in 2007. I did the show across Canada.
Yeah.
She was 17 years old at that time and, you know, talking to her mom and dad. You know, at that time, you know, they said, Ron, you know, we're having a tough time, you know, getting a record deal. And they did, right? And so, you know, I said, well, maybe you should go independent, which they did. Yeah. And of course, you know, with Scott Borchetta, and hey, the rest is history. But, you know, she was young and, you know, she had all these songs. But she had written, I think she was since 10 or 9 years old. I mean, it was amazing. Even then, it was hard to get, you know, signed, right?
Yeah, right.
And even then, you know, for her to get signed was hard. Well, she didn't get signed with a major label, so which was, you know, a big mistake for a major label. But anyway.
Yeah, they missed the boat there on that one.
They missed the boat, but they were such nice people. I mean, she's so real, you know. Back then, she's 17, she's so real. Her parents are so real. You know, they asked all kinds of questions but all of them, you know, most of them are really good people and I enjoyed working with. I mean, the list would go on and on and on. You know, there isn't really one favorite, but... Yeah. You know what, at the end of the day, you know, they just were just, to me, great people with a great talent and you know, enjoying to make people happy and sing and write and do what they do, you know, because they have that God-given gift. I mean, that is something else. It's a God-given gift that they can go out and just you know, sing like a bird. And every night after night after night, I'm thinking, I can't even talk that every night after.
Well, you've made some friends too, right? I know I saw Johnny Reed was talking about you and stuff, and you've got some people that you kind of gravitate towards and become friendly. And years ago, my manager told me, gave me some great advice. He said, Dan, in the music business, try to work with people who love music and who love musicians, because then you're less likely to be exploited and mistreated. And it sounds like you're one of those guys, and you've made some friends with these people.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and they are friends. I mean, right down from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and, you know, to the older groups and to, Toby Keith had just passed away. Yeah. I mean, you know, one day he called me, he says, Ron, he was into racehorses, right? And that's why he wrote that song, you know, Beer for My Horses. Beer and I was into racehorses too, right?
Cool.
And his mayor who won the $1 million race, but I owned the other mare that was her sister. Okay. And so he thought, okay, maybe he wants to buy that for broodmare, right? And I didn't really want to sell her. So he flew up, came to Lethbridge, you know, went to see the horse. And then I said, well, you know, I'd like to use her as a broodmare too. You know, I should have sold her. Mm-hmm. But because, you know, in the racehorse business, you know, the only time you make $1 million is if you start with six.
So, yeah, exactly. That's right. So make you a millionaire. You got to start with $6 million first.
So anyway, we had dinner and then said our goodbyes, got into his plane and flew back to his home. And at that time, Cabo St. Lucas, because it was in wintertime, he came up to Lethbridge. But, and anyway, yeah, you know, just those things. And, you know, Vince Gill, he came to golf, my golf course. I own a golf course called Paradise Canyon in Lethbridge.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it just won 25 years in a row, the top course in Southern Alberta, right? It's a great golf course. I had the PGA tournament there twice. And so he came and played it. And a lot of artists do come and play it because they're coming through from Montana. They'll stop off in Lethbridge, play my course, and they'll play like the Calgary Stampede or Edmonton Klondike Days or wherever. But, you know, they'll call me and they stop off and play it. And so, you know, a lot of friends, a lot of great friends, you know.
Yeah,
and,
that's nice. Yeah. Because, I mean, that's what, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, music is music and business is business, but it's the friendships and the relationships, really, when you look back on your life and you think, you know, that guy was a great guy, that guy helped me, the people that help you when you need help, or the people that you've made a difference in their lives. Those are the things that you cherish, I think, as you get older.
Oh, absolutely. You know, just last month, Shania's sister called me and says, Ron, we're coming through Lethbridge, you know, so they can stay at my, you know, at my condos there and golf for a couple of days, and then they'll carry on across Canada.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was the first one to do Shania's shows, and, you know, it was just exciting to see her blossom into what she is today. You know, it's great memories. And, you know, it's great. I mean, it's, they're just the same, you know, they have this, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're just great people.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah. And dealing with, you know, I was talking to a guy the other day, I said, I just want to deal with my friends. Just treat me like a friend. That's all I care about. I just want to, everybody wins. Treat me like a friend. If I owe you money, I'll pay you. If you owe me money, you pay me. We're good. And that's all I'm interested in these days.
You know, Dan, that's exactly right. You know, and but it's really, really, you know, fun making money, you know, with your friends.
Yeah, well, there you go. It really, it's a win-win, right?
It's a win-win. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's how the world turns, you know. Yeah, there are some people out there that are, you know, a little different, but anyway, you know, it's really a lot of fun making money, doing your job, building a business with your friends.
Yeah. And so how did you manage the hard work, like the long days and the trips and the stress? I mean, did you tour with some of the bands? You must have gone out on some of the shows, especially the ones you had a lot of skin in the game.
yeah, first I went, you know, out with most of them. And, you know, they just, I just go on the bus, yeah, you know, with Tim McGraw, you know, Tim says, Ron, you know, you got to, as he's starting off, you know, he said, Ron, you can come with me, because he's, you know, he's always working out, you know, he's always such a buff guy and, right, and a sportsman. He says, I'm coming to Canada for the first time. You know, we're going into the Rockies. I want you to take me skiing. Yeah. So I took him to Banff skiing, you know, when we played Calgary, and then when we played going through the Rockies, you know, into Kamloops skiing, and then and when we played Vancouver, took him to Whistler, and you know, he was such a sportsman, right? I mean, really, yeah, strong and really in shape, yeah, and after Dan, as he got bigger, and I produced his shows after, he had a van that he carried his workout and his gym.
Oh,
he had a mobile gym inside there that he worked out every day. There you know, that's go. Yeah, that's yeah, how, you know, he kept in shape and really, yeah, was an amazing, like, holy cow, strong.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but you know, you see, you know, these guys that some of them, you know, it's a business now, you know. You don't go out and see people get hammered out of their mind anymore, right? And you don't, right, see, you know, it's a business for them now, and they make good money, and they don't on the road, you know, it's business, and when they get off the road, I guess they do what they want to do, but on the, yeah, road, you know, it's mostly, Dan, it's mostly business, and the way it, well, should, yeah, be.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that, because you went through that golden era, but part of that package was the drugs and the booze thing and the big egos. Like, you got the big personalities, but that comes with the big egos too. So how did you manage that? Did you have any kind of say over, I don't know, drug and alcohol use or times when you had to calm things down?
Well, you know how I did that? I used to, and I saw when it was like a lot of the pop and rock culture or bands, and they went into disco. And so I said, this is crazy. So you know what I did? I turned around, flew to Nashville, and I said, I'm going to do country artists.
Hmm.
So that's why I started doing country artists.
Interesting.
Because, yeah, you know, because they were a lot easier to deal with than, you know, the big egos, not big egos. And so, I remember John Huey, you know, he was the one of the vice presidents of CAA in Nashville, one of the biggest agencies. And so I walked into there and I explained my story, and he looked down. And now John's about 6'6", you know, big guy. And he looks at me and he says, now tell me something. Here's a guy from Canada called Ron Sakamoto, owns a company, a Jewish company, name company called Golden Gold Productions, come to Nashville, want to book my country artist into Canada.
Yeah.
This sounds so crazy, it might work.
Yeah.
And so he said, Ron, you're my man in Canada. So he took me around to all the agents in, wow, CAA and said, yeah, this is our guy. Any bands, this is our guy in Canada. So he, yeah, really helped me. He's such a nice friend, and, yeah, you know, and so that's how I got out of doing the drug stuff, and it wasn't, okay, all that. It wasn't all that drug
stuff. No, I know.
Just, you know, yeah, but anyway, and so that's what got, yeah, me into country, and for 17 years in a row, I won the Canadian Country Music Promoter of the Year Award.
Yeah, there you go.
Until they asked me to step down, and they named the award after me. So now that award is the Ron Sakamoto Promoter of the Year Award forever.
Yeah, I saw that. That's great. Well, no, I was going to say that, you know, the country guys are more down home. It's, you know, God and country and family and traditional values and just being humble. I mean, people who are stars or who have been successful in life should be the most humble people in the world and the most thankful. And quite often they're not, but in country music, you tend to hear that more, that they're thankful and grateful for what they've received.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, got a little wilder now, but you know, at that time, you know, it was like, you know, pretty calm, you know, and you know, it wasn't, you didn't have to worry about, you know, guys throwing TV sets out the window in their you know, in a hotel room, because they were so hammered. So anyway, that's how I got around that. That's why I got into country.
Yeah.
And that's why I built a country business up, right? Even though I started in rock and pop.
Yeah.
And I still do rock and pop. I mean, we're going to be doing Ice Cube, for crying out loud. I haven't done that for a long time. It's coming up. We're going to put them on sale. But I got Cody Johnson on sale. We're selling out everywhere. You know, so, you know, you just keep building different kind of artists that you really want to do, right?
Yeah. Well, that's I think, is a good point. You can sort of pick and choose, right? You look at it and say, can we make money on this tour? Are they decent people? Are they going to show up? Are they going to be in good shape? Are they going to participate and be professional? I mean, those are the questions that are running through your mind, I would assume.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the first time I did, you know, Old Dominion, I mean, holy cow, I couldn't believe how talented they were. And I knew they were going to get big. And of course, I think they won the group of the year, what, 4 or 5 years in a row now. And, you know, I'm booking their next tour in 2025 already. But the talent is unbelievable. The business is unbelievable. Their manager, agent, I mean, you know, how good the band is because the manager and agent are just as good. And so it's just, you know, and if the promoter, manager, agent, and the band are all good, you know, it usually is a formula for success.
Yeah, nice. And just a sort of an oddball question, but I always ask my guests, what's your position on CanCon and the CanCon regulations that came in the early 70s? Did that help you or hurt you or didn't affect you?
I don't think it affected me. It hurt. It helped the band, helped the Canadian, I think, because, you know, the radio stations had to then play some Canadian because if the CanCon wouldn't have came in, I think that, you know, a lot of the bands wouldn't have got played, right? Because Americans were so strong. You know, they're so strong, you know, they're so, you know, kind of rule the world, right? So this way it helped the Canadian artists. And I think it all helped.
Okay, yeah, no, I appreciate that. I usually ask my guests. Some people were not totally in favor of it, but one person made a point, like, breaking a band is like getting the zipper started. You got to get the zipper started at the bottom before you can zip it up, and the CanCon helps you get the zipper started, I guess. It's kind of an analogy for trying to break the band. You get a bit more play, and then people realize there's substance there. You're not giving fluffy bands something they don't deserve. They earn it, they step up to it, but you got to give them the platform.
That's exactly right. But now, Dan, I think it's easier because you got social media all over the place, TikTok, everything else. I mean, somebody has one song and they get signed and they don't know, I don't even know who they are. You know, they're called Tom Jones or whoever, right? One song and they're from like Timmins, Ontario. And, but so, now, because of all the social media, I don't know how important that is anymore because, you know, you're getting so many bands and kids and anybody, you know, doing a cut on social media.
Yeah, good point. And CanCon doesn't matter on the internet because it's irrelevant there, right?
So no, not at all. No. And that's why you see some of these bands that all of a sudden come out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah. So another question, sort of an aside question. Did you ever get to, you're obviously an ancestry is Japanese. Did you ever get to Japan? You ever do any shows over there?
I didn't do any show. I was just in Japan last April. Went all around Japan and I went to Hokkaido where my folks come from. Visited and I was just there. Unbelievable country, you know, no guns, no shootings, there's no garbage. There's like, it's unbelievable. Like, you know, the washrooms are all clean. The food is great, but you know, I love Japanese food anyway, but, you know, it was a, it's a, you know, the culture. Culture is way different, you know.
And I had to ask because obviously the time that you came up, I mean, Japan loved Western music, right? And everybody's goal, one of the goals that a lot of the bands had was to go and play in Japan because it was such a big deal. So I just wondered if you had any connection, given your that being your ancestral home, I guess, and any connection there, if you ever did any international shows or particularly in Japan.
No, you know, I talked to one of the biggest promoters there, Mr. Udo, in Tokyo, but, you know, I never did bring any bands to Japan because, for me, you know, I just, hey, Canada's good enough.
Yeah.
I didn't need to do that. And, you know, he was such a gentleman, and, you know, I just know I didn't do any shows in Japan. Yeah.
Well, again, and the legal part of it that maybe some people don't think about too much, but having a promoter at least assisting you or something in the country where you're going to be promoting shows. I mean, if you're promoting shows in a foreign nation, there's a lot of potential legal issues and problems that can go along with that as well because you're entering a different country and there's different considerations.
Absolutely. Even in the States, you know, I did Tanya Tucker and she wanted me to produce her in the States. And so I did Montana, Idaho, Washington. But holy cow, you know, even when you sold out the shows, you had to, all these rules, regulations, taxes, you had to pay taxes right away. Yep. You had the IRS on you. You had to hire everybody in the United States except take your money down. And so that, you know, after that one run, I said, this is ridiculous. You know, I can't do that anymore because it's so much work. My accountant in Canada said, Ron, you know, you made like 5 cents.
And, yeah, there you go.
And so, there's a lot to it that, you know, I think I would have had to a partner with the United States company, which I never did, but maybe, but anyway, no. So I didn't even attempt to, do shows in Japan.
So, but you were on the other side of that in Canada, because if someone from Nashville, for example, wants to come up here and say, well, Ron's our guy, well, you know the Canadian laws, you got a Canadian company, you know the landscape, and you can help them. So I'm sure you did on the opposite side, you helped out.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, my accountants, you know, the withholding tax and everything else and all that stuff for the bands, you know, we did it all, you know.
Yeah, so, nice.
Yeah.
So then the last year you won the Walt Grealis Special Achievement Award. I saw on the Junos. Very nice. It must have felt good.
Yeah, it was awesome. You know, the Junos, I mean, it was, first of all, it was a surprise. And when they said, you know, would you accept it? And it because it Junos entails not just country, but pop and rock and rap and all parts of music. And to win that award, I mean, it's not many have been given out, right?
Yeah.
And what was really special for me was to have Bruce Allen induct me. You know, nice. I mean, Bruce and I have been friends for 40 years, 50 years, you know, and to have him do that was just so special for me. I just, you know, can't. Thank him enough.
Yeah, I watched the video. It was very nice, very touching.
Well, we've been friends for so long and, you know, old friends.
No, that's right, because he started Bruce Allen Talent in the mid-70s, I guess early 70s it would have been back then. So he's been around a long time. And then what's your history at the Junos? Do you attend every year or have you ever been to them before? Or?
Well, I have, but not, you know, because they have a few country categories, but you know, I have, but you know, I mean, you got to pick your spots too, right? You can't attend every award under the sun, but I've gone to the Junos, but you know.
Cool. And then another great aspect of what you do is you give back to the community. So I really appreciate that as well. That again, that humility and gratitude that comes with being successful. You know, the music programs and the reading programs and the community support for natural disasters that you helped out on. You know, that's something you don't have to do, but you're giving back.
Well, you know, the University of Lethbridge, my wife and I have $750,000 scholarship that I think, I don't know how many students they use the interest on it. And then we started the program there at the university. And also I have a management scholarship at the University of Lethbridge. I have a golf scholarship at the college. And, you know, when the flood hit Calgary, and well, not just Calgary, but all of Alberta,
you know, river.
We helped with Jeff Perry and myself and Harvey Gold put together a festival at the McMahon Stadium. And people thought we'd never be able to pull it off, because we pulled it off in about a month and a half. Sold it out. I think we made about $2.2 million for Calgary.
That's great.
Yeah. And so, you know, but you have, you know, you have to give back. I mean, it's like, if we can, and not everybody can, but, you know, we're so fortunate to be able to do that. And, and so, you know, we do. And it makes you, you know, it makes you feel very, very good. And people, you know, respect you. And you know, they, especially when I bought my golf course, I mean, every year we donate with the tournaments almost $1 million a year to charities.
Yeah.
And so we help them, you know, do that. Different organizations do that with my golf course at Paradise Canyon, because we do, I think, about 40 tournaments, right?
Nice.
And so the biggest tournament, I think, raises about $150,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so, and then there's the little ones, you know, there's the little ones, lots of little ones too, but, you know, but it all goes back into the community, right?
Yeah.
Every cent goes back into the community, and we, you know, we take pride in doing that for sure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's something that makes, you know, makes my whole family, you know, very, very proud that we can do that.
Well, I think it's a natural extension of the relationships too, because in a sense, you have a relationship with people, but you have a relationship with your community as well. And years ago, I remember the saying that somebody had said, your life is defined not by what you get, but by what you give.
You know, that's absolutely right. That's just absolutely correct. You know, that is, that's a wonderful saying.
Yeah. And so giving back in the community, even people you don't know, but people get a benefit from those things that you do. So looking back on your life, are you surprised by the speed of it all? I mean, I talk to lots of people and I ask them, you know, how were you reflecting on it at the time? And a lot of people say, well, you know, I was just working. I wasn't really reflecting on it. But now I think you're going to be 80 years old soon. Is that right?
In three weeks, I'll be 81.
There you
and,
go.
You so, know, like, yeah, my wife says we've been married almost 41 years, and you've only been home for 20 of them, right?
There you go.
Because I've been on the road so long.
So, are you surprised how fast it went?
You know what, Dan? It went by so fast, you know. And I tell people, I said, well, Ron, when are you going to quit? I said, never.
No, good
you
for
know,
you.
Never. Because, you know, the God bless his soul, Mary Harry Viner said, Ron, don't retire. Because when you retire, you start to die. So I remember those words. And he never retired. And, you know, and he was such a hardworking guy. And he loved life. And so I said, you know, my next goal, because I've always had a goal in life, Dan. Yeah. My next goal is, I was watching television one day. And they said, oh, somebody's going to break the world record. 100 meter dash. Oh, okay. And it's 106 seconds or something. I said, wow, that's crazy. I know Usain Bolt has the record at 9 seconds. But then they said, no, there's two records. One is 100 years and younger, and one is 100 years and older.
Oh.
Now, this was filmed by TSN, and it was in England, and English lady was going to run this race, and she ran it, and I think she broke it at 104 seconds. So I said, hey, that's my next goal. When I turn 100, I'm going to you know, I'm going to bring the them down here, and I'm going to try and break that record. I don't know what it would be by then, 20 years from now, but okay. But Dan, that's my next goal.
Yeah, no, I love it. Well, you're still very active. That's inspirational. And I often say, too, you know, I love playing music. And so people bring up the word retirement. And my question is, retire from what? My life?
Yeah. I
like what I do.
Yeah, you love what you do. And I love what I do. And, you know, whether it be golf or, you know, I may go down and play some cards at my casino. I have a partner in a casino, too. And so, you know, on the racetrack, I had horses. But Dan, I told you, you know, I got out of them because it just cost me so much money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, good for you. That's really inspirational. So looking back, is there anything you'd change about the course of your career? Anything you'd do differently if you could take another swing?
No, Dan, I don't think so. You know, I've had a great life. You know, I'm down here in Arizona while you're interviewing me, and I had a house down here for what, 15 years now, you know, and out of the winter, and then I'll go back home, and I have great people working for me and with me, you know, I don't think I'd change anything. You know, it's 74 degrees here today, and golfing tomorrow and the next day. And you know, I'm on a golf course here, private golf course. And so, you know, like life has been good, and I don't think I'd change a thing.
Well, good for you. I mean, it's obviously you're a happy person, and you know, success doesn't always bring happiness and contentment, as you know, and you've no doubt witnessed some people with artists and people that have been enormously successful in one area of life and not so much in the personal aspect of life. So those things are not synonymous.
You're absolutely correct. And I don't understand it sometimes, you know, and money doesn't make you successful or happy, you know, are happy, I guess, because some people have tons and yet they're miserable. And I don't know why, but, you know, whether it's a personality or what it is, but, you know, you just wonder, wow, why are they so angry? Like they're angry at the world or something, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't understand it, but, you know, it's really, really strange sometimes.
Well, I think people can be enormously successful in something that they pursued, but then be sort of shallow or hollow in the inside because they don't have that sort of personal fulfillment. So I think, to me, it's about life balance, being happy, being a good person, giving back, being gratitude is a major factor, being thankful. I mean, we live in a free country. We've got peace and prosperity and opportunities everywhere. We got nothing to be upset about. We're in a good situation.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, and here's a little instance. You know, a couple of years ago, a number of years ago, the school said, Mr. Sakamoto, you know, we want to start a music program. I said, what do you need? He says, 36 guitars. I said, okay, I'll buy them. Yep. They started the music program. And I said, hey, you know, maybe one of you guys are going to be like a Keith Urban or a, you know, a rock star coming out of here, you never know. Yeah. And then one year, the teachers' organization said, Ron, you know, a lot of kids don't know how to read very well. And so I said, okay, what do you need? He said, books. So I bought the city school division, my wife and I, 13,000 books. So every child from kindergarten to grade 12 had a book. They read this book, and it brought the author. The author came to Lethbridge, and so to start that reading program. So, you know, it's something that really makes you feel great when you can help people. And now this is in Lethbridge because, you know, I'm not going to, I live here.
But
it's something that it really makes you, you know, feel good. My wife and I, really, really good when we can do that.
Well, exactly. And that's I guess my point is that a lot of people who seem successful are just all about ego and self-indulgence and those kinds of things. And those things in excess rob your life of meaning. They don't add to the meaning of your life. So the balance is important and the giving, I think.
Yeah. You know, when you learn how to give, you learn how to live.
Yeah. That's a good one. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. What an interesting, fascinating guy you are, and thanks for sharing and being so open. And you know, I'm really happy that you're a happy person. That makes me happy too, because that's really more important than anything else, I think.
That is, Dan. You know, it really, really is. And I know I watched my parents, and my parents, my dad was 96 when he passed away, my mother 93, my grandfather 93. Wow. So, you know, I said, well, I got the genes to make 100 and run that race.
Yeah,
that's
you do
what I'm going to do, Dan.
No, that's great. Many thanks to my guest, Ron Sakamoto, for being part of the Liner Notes podcast and sharing some insights from his many musical adventures and accomplishments in life. More information is available. He's part of Golden Gold Productions. That's his company, and Sakamoto Management, and then SakamotoAgency.com as well. He's involved with that. So we hope you enjoyed the podcast and invite you to subscribe to it and share it on social media so others can enjoy it as well. Until next time, I'm Dan Harris.